Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, journalist Mark Bowden discusses his new book, The Steal, the attempt to overturn the 2020 election and the people who stopped it. Co-written with Matthew Teague, Bowden is interviewed by reporter Natalie Y. Moore. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Here to talk about what happened in 2020 and what's at stake this fall are Mark Bowden and Natalie Moore. Mark Bowden is the author of 15 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Black Hawk Down. He reported at the Philadelphia Inquirer for 20 years and now writes for The Atlantic and other magazines. Natalie Y. Moore is an award-winning journalist based in Chicago, whose reporting tackles race, housing, economic development, food injustice, and violence. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. And thank you for writing this book. I guess not to sound, everything is alarming in this book. And one of my big takeaways is if Trump wins or if Trump loses, democracy is holding on by a thread. Yeah. And so I would first like for you, let me give a little bit of a setup what the authors do. So we've seen the images, we know what was happening in all these states, and this book just takes us really, really like hyper-local into Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Arizona. What state am I missing?
Nevada.
And we get to know these characters, it reads like a thriller because you feel like you're reading it in real time, and it, you know, bounces from state to state. So there's so many characters in this book, in these states, who don't believe that Joe Biden won. Can you just tell us about a few of these characters, whichever ones you feel compelled to have us spend some time with?
Sure. You know, Matt and I, when we started working on this, were aware that there's a huge amount of reporting done in Washington about Trump and his inner circle and all the people who were involved in Washington, up to and including the attack on the Capitol building on January 6th. And what we wanted to do was go in the other direction, because Trump could not have done this on his own. There were thousands and thousands of people all over the country who, and I'm not just talking about the millions of people who voted for him and the many tens of thousands of people who showed up to demonstrate. I'm talking about people who actually worked on trying to falsify the results of this election. So we looked at the six swing states, which you named, and found the key people, both who were working to overturn the election and those who actually upheld the election. And there is actually good news in this book, in that there were people in all of these six states, many of them Republicans, many of them Trump supporters, who simply refused to be dishonest, or as dishonest as Trump wanted them to be. Nevertheless, there were a large number of people who fed this effort to intimidate election workers, to try to falsify the election results, to try and prevent the certification of the votes, and then ultimately to foist a false slate of electors to send to Washington in hopes that Vice President Pence would derail the final certification of the votes. So, you know, when I started working on this, I wasn't just interested in choosing people at random, even though as you read the story, you read about, say, someone like Leah Hoops from Delaware County, just outside of Philadelphia. Leah is convinced that the Democratic and Republican parties in the United States are actually one party, and that they work together to orchestrate the elections to the end that they want. So the fact that there were Republican observers at the polls, along with Democratic observers at the polls, doesn't mean anything to her. So she mounted this effort to try to convince people that there was this enormous fraud going on. She had no evidence for this, but she posted a lot, and she got a lot of people to pay attention to her. And the story goes on. But you know what's interesting is you read about Leah Hoops, and you think, well, this is just one kind of kooky person in Delaware. Or you read about this woman whose name is now going to escape me in Arizona, who claimed when she looked at a spreadsheet of the election results, she claimed to see the signature of Satan in the results. And, you know, and she believed this. But these are not people chosen at random. These were the people who were the lead plaintiffs in Donald Trump's lawsuits trying to overturn the election results. And tells you a little bit why every one of the 61 lawsuits that they filed all over the country failed, because judges just looked at this and said, are you kidding? And in fact, we quote, you know, what many of the justices said in so many words. So there were no shortage of characters.
I'm looking for I can't remember the woman's name in Arizona either, but she was a veterinarian chiropractor.
Exactly. Yeah,
I remember.
Veterinarian chiropractor who had never been involved. And, you know,
in elections, like this was...
Well, that's the other key feature. A lot of these people have never been involved in elections at all. And so they didn't know how elections work in America. And to be honest, I didn't either. You know, I've never really given it that much thought. When I wrote this book...
Lenny Stone. Yes.
And was lovely. I mean, she wanted to talk about it. I mean, she'll tell you exactly why she did what she did and how she felt, and still feels justified. But the one characteristic I was beginning to explain is that none of them have any familiarity with elections and how they're run. And it's an incredible process. I mean, you know, a lot of people would think that national elections must be run out of some big building in Washington, D.C., where somebody controls them. And in fact, our national elections are run in every neighborhood, in every county, in every city, in every state, with literally tens of thousands of your neighbors, my neighbors, volunteering to count votes or to be at the polling place on election day to help people file their votes. And so those are just the people involved. And then you get into the machinery of the election and the fact that 2020 was the first, was, you know, during COVID. So suddenly a lot of states permitted mail-in balloting, so because they were afraid people wouldn't want to show up at the polls. And of course, this became a motivation for Trump to claim that mail-in voting was somehow inherently corrupt, and interestingly hurt him, because he lost the election in states where they had discouraged Republicans from voting by mail. And now you may notice the Republican National Committee, even though they're still going to put Trump up as their candidate, are encouraging people to vote by mail. That turned out to be a pretty bad strategy.
Because some of the Republican leaders on the ground in these counties were saying, this is going to hurt.
Yeah.
But there was this image that early voting is only for Black people, for young people.
Urban voters.
Yeah.
That's the key word.
Yeah, urban is the euphemism that is used.
But urban voters, you know, are, you know, you do get larger numbers of minority voters in cities and then large numbers. So in a state like Wisconsin, which is mostly rural, Republicans throughout Wisconsin are frustrated every big election, because when the returns come in from Milwaukee, It just overturns everything that they expect to happen. I mean, they could drive literally for hundreds of miles without ever seeing a Biden sign. So it's really easy for them to believe that nobody's really voting for Joe Biden until 200,000 votes show up in Milwaukee and suddenly all of their hopes are dashed. That all of this feeds into this conspiratorial thinking.
One of the things that struck me pretty early on, and I'm glad you mentioned Leah, because I was thinking about her and her partner in crime, Greg Sinstrom.
Yeah.
It was the audacity. Can you imagine showing up at a polling place and demanding to go in the back to see how things are being counted, demanding to see the machines, calling a lawyer, and not leaving when you're told no? What do you make of that kind of boldness?
Well, what it says to me, Natalie, is that if you go out to be an observer at the polls and you go with the assumption that something crooked is taking place, you're looking everywhere and you're convinced that every door that's closed is hiding the people who are actually doing the crime. Everything that you don't understand that happens around you is more proof that something nefarious is going on. And so, you know, they went, Leah and Greg, to the county's voting center, convinced of what they were going to find. And it wasn't there. I mean, what they thought they were going to find is that hundreds of thousands of ballots had been printed up in advance, and they were all fake. And so they thought what was going on was that they were taking the real ballots, which had been cast by real people, and hiding them away in a back room and substituting all these pre-filled-in ballots. And let me just say, I mean, you're right. I mean, they're so convinced of this, then everyone who refuses to allow them to stand close to the machines or allows them to explore everywhere in the room, and these are people who are trying to do things like prevent votes from being stolen or removed, or there's also the privacy of the ballot to be protected, so they have a job to do. So, but everything they did was interpreted as part of the conspiracy. So, you know, the more they saw, the more convinced they got, the angrier they got, and anger plays well. You know, they go on, Leah would go out in the parking lot and sit in her car and post something on her social media, outraged by what's going on. You believe this crime that's taking place right in this building, right over here, and people listen to that who know even less than she does and are convinced that it's the truth.
What would you say were some of the common characteristics of the people who wanted to overturn or believed in the conspiracy in all of these different states, these different parts of the country?
Boy, that's a good question, and I don't know, because that's the thing that really intrigues me. You know, I know that the people who were trying to overturn the election believed they were doing the right thing, most of them, not all of them, most of them. When you get to the higher levels, I think there are people who know exactly what they're doing, and they're doing it very deliberately, and these are people who belong in jail. But then there are people who are doing it because they think they know something that everybody else doesn't. And the reasons are, you know, what are the reasons for Trumpism? It is a deep strain of anti-government in our country, which has always been there. There's a deep strain of anti-elitism, or intellectualism, which means that, and you saw it during COVID, which means if you have actually professional credentials to offer an informed opinion, that disqualifies you because it means that you are part of the conspiracy. But that is, again, another strain that's run deep in American society. I think racism is a big factor as well. I think that, you know, the demographics in this country are changing. You see it most particularly in big cities, where big cities increasingly the politics are controlled by African Americans and other minorities. Women are a much bigger factor in American politics than they've ever been in the past. And I think there's, you know, that's the slogan, Make America Great Again. That's what that's all about. They want to go back to a time when there was a male white power structure that some people feel reassured by, you know, and I think the world is changing in ways that frighten them, and so they read into everything, you know, conspiracy to destroy what they hold most dear.
So the name of this panel, this talk, is Writing Politics. How did you all get these people to open up and to talk to you? And I'm asking that too as a journalist. I mean, this is not easy work.
Well, you know, the answer to that question, Natalie, and you've probably found this to be true, is that you show up. Most people I've found in the many years that I've worked as a reporter are very eager to tell their stories, unless they don't trust you, unless they feel that you have an ulterior motive of some kind, or unless they're frightened for some reason. And I think your job as a journalist is to reassure people that you are genuinely interested in who they are, what they think, why they did what they did, if they have misgivings, to try to understand what those are and mitigate them. So, you know, in the case of someone like Leah Hoops, she was suspicious of me, but all I had to do was ask her some questions, and off she went. And I listened and listened and listened. And then I looked at her social media postings, and she had spilled her guts out there. The people who were really frightened to talk for this book were people like Ruby Freeman and
the woman,
daughter Shay Moss.
In Georgia, the black mother and daughter
who became
duo.
Targets
yeah.
of this ridiculous conspiracy that they were somehow substituting votes in Atlanta. And they were, you know, they were driven underground. I mean, they had to leave their jobs and go into hiding. They feared for their lives. They feared for their families. And so when we come as reporters wanting to talk to them again, I mean, they're like, we don't want to draw any more attention to ourselves because we're afraid. You know, but they eventually agreed to talk to us as well. And since, I mean, I think the Robert F. Kennedy Award for Courage was given to them at the JFK Library. There's been a great deal of sympathy extended for the suffering that they went through, which was completely unjust. But they're not alone. There were election workers in all of these six swing states who were targeted for harassment. Clint Hickman, who was the chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Commissioners, had death threats. Protesters on the front lawn of his property.
And he voted for Trump.
He did. He was a lifelong Republican and a Trump supporter. And his responsibility was to oversee the election in his county. And if there was ever anyone inclined to be skeptical about voting results in favor of Joe Biden, it would have been Clint Hickman, because he really wanted Trump to win. And he was, you know, as I say, a lifelong Republican, but he was not dishonest. And when it came time to actually hold hearings looking into the way the election was run, to do recounts, he did it. And he supervised it, and he did it honestly. And he became a target for Trump supporters as a result. So his life was turned upside down.
But the people like Leah distrust the media.
Yes.
And, you know, you're from the East Coast. Like, how did you, you know, which signals elitism to folks in other parts of the country, even though Delaware is on the East Coast. But right. For the other state, I forgot to mention Michigan, which I want to go back to a little bit later. But how did you, did you encounter any media elitism fears from people before they agreed to talk to you?
A little bit. I'm fortunate in that I have been doing this a long time, and a lot of people know who I am. And because I've written books about the military, and I wrote Black Hawk Down, a lot of people just assume that if you write about the military, that you must be a right-wing Republican person, you know?
Okay.
Which is not at all true. I mean, if you know the military, you know the military reflects society as a whole, and it's made up of a whole broad range of people, including the people who write about it, like me. But I think it does make some people who would be less inclined to talk to me more willing to. Believe me, I don't do anything to try to convince them that that's the case. All I ever tell people is I will, when I write, present you as honestly and accurately as I can. I am genuinely interested in what you think and why you did what you did and what you said. And I think I follow through on that. I mean, I know there were plenty of people who we wrote about in this book who were probably not real happy with the way they were portrayed, but they didn't quarrel that they were presented inaccurately. It was exactly, this is what they said, this is what they did, this is how they felt when they did it. So yeah, I mean, to some extent, I guess there are people who would have ducked us, but not many. You know, we worked very fast on this. We did this book in 5 months. And I'm real proud of how well we were able to do.
Did you all travel, or were a lot of these interviews on Zoom, or both?
Most of them were in person. But what we did was, this book was commissioned in the spring of 2021. So only like weeks after January 6th. And my publisher, Morgan Entrekin, called me and said, I'm at this time there was no January 6th commission pending. So he said, I don't really know if anybody's actually going to seriously investigate what happened in all these six swing states. I would like to do it. I would like for us to do it. And he asked me if I knew of anybody who might be interested in doing that. And I said, well, you know what? I would be interested in doing it, but I was under contract to do another book at the same time. And I said, you're going to want this done really quickly. So I said, if you are willing to hire a staff of young reporters who can travel, who can, you know, go and find these people and interview them, I will coordinate their work and I'll write it. You know, at the end, it ended up being myself and Matt Teague. We hired Matt to coordinate all these young reporters who were working on it. And Matt was writing me these memos explaining what was going on and what different people were doing. I was doing my own reporting in Pennsylvania. He was doing reporting in Georgia. I think he did a lot of reporting in Michigan. And I thought his memos were just so well written. And I realized that it would be so much easier for us to get this done in 5 months. So I said, let's do this together. And that's why it ended up being a collaboration. But there was a great deal of travel involved. And most of these people who we write about were interviewed in person. And I often then would follow up with my own interview by phone. But it was during COVID, but we still sent people out in the field.
It's quite a feat that you all did this so quickly.
Yeah, that we, you know.
And it doesn't feel amazing, rushed. Like if you would think, wow, they spent, it reads like it took years, but you know that it didn't because
Well, you
of
know
the
what?
Timing.
I'm so proud of the people who worked with me on this book, and I've never met any of them. And I've never actually met Matt Teague in person. We worked on this book for nearly a year, and it was during COVID, so we were all basically communicating via telephone or by video. And then even when the book came out, initially, the hardcover, Matt and I did all the media for that virtually. So we did it all on the computer, and I've never actually met him. The reason I came to Chicago, to be honest, in part, was because Matt was supposed to be here today, and I thought, oh, cool, I get to meet Matt. And then he got sick, and now you're stuck with just me. And I still haven't met it.
When I think about one of the commonalities of the people who believe in this deal is, and this is also how I feel about Donald Trump, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Certainly that's true of Trump. I mean, yeah. He is the person who convinces himself that what he's saying is true, regardless of anything else. I actually know Donald Trump. I spent 3 days with him once, back in 1996. Playboy magazine sent me to write a profile of Donald Trump. So I flew down to Mar-a-Lago with him and his then wife, Marla, and their little girl,
Tiffany. Why do I know this?
Yeah. We know too much about him. And he lied to me from the minute I met him until the minute I left him. Every story he told me proved false.
Did you know that at the time?
No, I didn't know that much about him. At the time, he was just a sort of a flamboyant and bankrupt real estate developer in New York. And he had squandered a fortune. This is after he'd bought his casinos and they had all fallen apart. And his companies were all in bankruptcy and judges had appointed professional managers to run his companies. And so he was kind of ruined. And so they wanted me to go spend time with him, and his whole goal was to convince me that he was mounting a big comeback, not because of his business acumen, but because of his talent for self-promotion. But he talked my ear off about everything under the sun, and then you do what reporters do, you go back and check and see if
this, if your mother says she loves you, check it out.
Yeah. And I mean, he lied about everything. I mean, we walked into this room down at Mar-a-Lago, which had a really beautiful rug with like a castle, a children's fairy tale castle in it. And he said to me, this was created by Walt Disney before he got into animated movies. Completely untrue. I mean, Walt Disney got into making animated films like 20 years before Mar-a-Lago was even built. And, you know, there's no way that this rug came from him. You know, he lectured me on how planes fly. I actually know a little bit about how planes fly. But here, I'll tell you, you hear my tennis story?
Please.
Yeah. He told me what a good tennis player he was, right? And this is about how many years ago? 28 years ago?
You said 1996.
Okay. 1996. I was younger than myself, and I actually was a fairly serious tennis player. I played tournaments and ranked, but he had found out that I played tennis, and so he says, you know, I love to play tennis. Let's play. I said, great, we'll hit when we go down to Mar-a-Lago. So he has these beautiful tennis courts at Mar-a-Lago, clay courts. And there's a guy named Anthony Boole, who is the pro down there. And he keeps those courts in meticulous condition. And he has tournaments, and he has lessons and programs set up down at Mar-a-Lago that run all the time. So Donald arrives, and he comes out in his tennis whites. And he wants me to hit with Anthony before he hits with me. So I'm hitting with Anthony, and then I guess he just decided he didn't want to hit with me. So he didn't have anything to do. So he was stomping around, and there was a water fountain that had been installed between two of these gorgeous tennis courts. And there was a little metal pump, the electrical pump, next to the water fountain, which provides the energy to pump the water up. Well, he started like kicking this metal box and saying, what is this doing here? Why isn't this metal box inside of the stone pedestal? And Anthony is trying to explain, well, they couldn't do it for this reason or that reason. Meanwhile, Trump rips the metal box off out of the cement and sends water spraying all over Anthony's tennis courts.
Clay courts.
And you can just see his face fall. All the work that's gone into getting ready for this long weekend is suddenly ruined. And then Trump kind of stomps over to me and he says, well, I guess you're going to write about that. And I said, yeah, I'm going to write about that. So it was downhill from there. The other thing that was interesting was, and you see this in his tenure in the White House, is it's terrifying to work for him because you are either the most talented genius on the planet, or you're an idiot. As he would put it, you're a fucking idiot. And you go from being a genius to a fucking idiot in a split second. And there's no way to protect yourself from this. So, for instance, there was a woman whose job it was to decorate this big ballroom at Mar-a-Lago, and she had chosen like five different shades of gold. Everything is gold. And he was supposed to choose which one he liked best. And of course, he looks at them and he says, you choose, right? Well, I had seen what happened when he walked into the locker room and he didn't like the color of the rug that they used in the locker room. What fucking idiot put this rug down here? So the people who work for him are living on that knife's edge all the time because he could change his mind about them in an instant if they inadvertently do something that he doesn't like.
How did that Playboy article turn out?
It was fine, you know. I'm proud of it. And you can find it online. At the time, he hated it, and I think he still hates it. But what was this? He had an assistant, a lovely woman, who tracked me down after the story ran. And she said, Mr. Trump, I was in a hotel room somewhere. She said, Mr. Trump would like to talk to you about that story. And I knew that he was furious about the story because he had already called Christy Hefner to scream about how terrible it was and how they betrayed him and everything else. So I just figured, okay, you know, I'll take it from him. And then she came back on the phone after like 2 minutes and she said, he's too livid to speak. So he never confronted me over his unhappiness about that story. But if you had told me back then one day he would be president of the United States, yeah, I would not have ever believed it.
No. Yeah.
What do you do?
So what you all do throughout the book repeatedly is debunk the lies.
Yeah, not hard.
You give people, I don't want to say that people came off as sympathetic, because I don't think that's what you were trying to do. But the people who are trying to overturn, they have their space to say what they want to say. And then there are beats where the framing throughout the book, there's never any ambiguity about, oh, we just have to hear what they have to say and let the reader decide. It's like, this didn't happen. This is a lie.
Yeah.
This is not true. So with the writing process, how did you figure out at which beats to do that, and while giving people their say?
Well, there's, you know, the just like in interviewing Trump, if he tells you a story, you check it out. So, I mean, I listened, when I started working on this, if I listened to Leah Hoops and Greg Stenstrom explain to me how votes were manipulated in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, then I would go out and actually look into how did they actually run the election in Delaware County, and are some of the things that they're saying plausible, and discover that, in fact, a lot of the things that they're saying are simply impossible. I mean, they're, for instance, you know, the claim that Dominion voting machines were rigged, you know, and were being controlled somewhere else. Well, we've already seen in court, you know, the Fox News took the largest single defamation award in American history, because it's provably false. You cannot do what they were claiming you could do with these machines. For one thing, they aren't connected to the internet. They're not connected to the outer world. They're very hermetically sealed machines. And all they do is count a paper ballot and take a picture of it. So there is a paper ballot that remains, and so it allows them to tabulate digitally the vote so that it can happen much more quickly. And in fact, it happens, takes a long time still, because there's so many votes. But the hard copy of the ballot remains. So if you claim that, you know, they're switching the votes, then you can go back and check and see whether they were switched. And the other thing that is that too little is made of this, I think. But in Michigan, they discovered, because the county clerk in Michigan made a mistake, which she realized herself that she made and corrected.
And she was a Republican.
She was a Republican. She had inadvertently, mistakenly counted 2,000 votes for Biden that should have gone for Trump. And so she admitted it, corrected it, but in the time, 2,000 votes, right? That story went all over the world. The Trump Organization was flying lawyers in to her district, her clerk, trying to convince her to tell people that the reason those 2,000 votes were recorded inaccurately was because someone had rigged the machines, which she knew was not true, because she had made the mistake herself. You know, the machines had not made the mistake, and she refused, as did Clint Hickman and a number of other officials, you know, refused to be as dishonest as they wanted her to be. But the larger point I want to make is that that was 2,000 votes, and those 2,000 votes were noticed immediately. And the reason they were is that we know, because of previous decades of election counting, of ballot counting, pretty much how the vote is going to turn out in every voting district in America. I mean, not to the point where if it's close, we can't always say who's going to win, but we know the voting patterns everywhere. That's, for instance, why there are swing states. There are 6 swing states, because those states, the voting patterns in those states are close enough that you can't really know in advance how it's going to turn out. You go to Arkansas, you pretty much know, you know, the way the election is going to turn out. You go to New York, you pretty much know the way the election is going to turn out. But Pennsylvania, because of the way Pennsylvania is built, Georgia, Arizona, which is in the flux of a big shift from Republican to Democrat right now, things are still up in the air. So how many votes would it take in a state like Pennsylvania to change the outcome for Joe Biden versus Trump? We're talking hundreds of thousands of votes, right? So if a district that traditionally has been 60% Republican, 40% Democrat, is suddenly 100% Republican, which is what it would be if somebody had faked all those ballots and filled them out in advance, or if they wanted to cover their tracks a little bit, maybe it would be suddenly 80%, you know, Republican, 20% Democrat. The point is, it would be immediately noticeable by the computers that track election results, which you see being reported on TV networks and on election night. They track all of these election results very carefully. If there's an unjustifiable or a surprising switch in the number of votes in any particular place, it sets up an immediate red flag, which calls for a recount, and that's what happens when those things go on. In the 2020 election, there were none. There were no districts in the country that signaled to the election board in that county or that state that those election results were disproportionate. So in, for instance, Leah Hoop's county, which went for Biden, Delaware County had long been a Republican county, and if you look at the election results over the last 20 years, they have gradually been inching up as the area has become more suburban Philadelphia. Those votes have been edging up into more and more Democrats every election. Until I think it was in the 2016 election, for the first time, Democrats won countywide office. So either the demographics have changed, which is what all the election results actually show, or, as Leah Hoops would conclude, the fix was in. You know, this is a Republican county, and there's no way that the people in this county would all vote for Democrats in these numbers. It has to be fixed.
As a reporter, it's important to get lies on the record, especially by elected officials, and so the public can see them lying, and it's a record of it. And reporters go back and call that lie out. And this isn't just for presidential. I'm talking about, you know, even in a city like Chicago or, you know, wherever a reporter is. The rules of engagement are, I think, a little tougher when you're dealing with people who hold elected office. When you're dealing with people who are liars but are regular citizens, would you all go back to them and say, hey, this isn't true? Or would you or the team challenge these people during the interview? How did you balance that?
Generally not, although there have been many occasions in my work where I have. But in this case, because we were working very quickly, we were gathering people's stories. We wanted people to explain. Why did you do what you do? Who you did? Why do you think this way? What were your reasons? And then we were going also out and doing our own research and reporting. So we never, I think if you're making a television program or a radio show, it's important, and it creates a dramatic moment. But when you're writing a book, not so much. I mean, we're just interested in explaining what happened. And so, no, I didn't make a point of calling people and saying, we can show that you're wrong. Although, in one or two cases, the details of this are going to elude my mind, but there was this guy in Arizona who claimed that Sharpies were being used.
I just had that page open.
Sharpies were being used on ballots, and this was a plot to get the voting machine to record incorrectly. Because his claim was, if you mark the ballot with a Sharpie, then it wouldn't show up on the scanning machine when it voted. And so he claimed that the Democrats in Maricopa County were handing out Sharpies to Republican voters so that their votes wouldn't count. Well, it turned out that they had a problem with the voting machines because the ballpoint pens that people were using were gumming up the machine. As the ballots went through, traces of the ballpoint ink were creating problems. They found that Sharpies actually work great. because it didn't come up the machine at all. So they were encouraging everybody. And so, and then their point to us was, well, how would we know the people standing in line to vote, which ones were going to vote Republican and which ones were going to vote Democrat? We were handing out Sharpies to everybody. So, I mean, these are things. And I did call this guy back, and he said, well, then they had somebody later who was rerunning the ballots through the machines in order to disqualify all of these Republican votes. And again, and I did tell him, I said, well, you know, if that were true, there would be a really sudden anomaly in the pattern of votes from these districts. And that anomaly is not there. The pattern fits everything that we've seen all running up to it. He says, you know, well, that's just, they're, you know, they're tricky. They're, you know, here, I'll tell you a little story about something else. I used to write a column in the newspaper, and I one time made the mistake of making a flippant reference to people who did believe that NASA actually never landed anything on the moon. And so this prompted a flood of complaints to me, phone calls, emails, you know, how can you believe this, you know, that NASA actually landed on the moon? And this one person wrote to me and said, well, if Apollo spacecraft actually landed on the moon, why can't telescopes from Earth take pictures of the Apollo craft on the moon? The answer is they can, and they exist. So I sent him the pictures, and he wrote back, think how easy that would be to fake. So you just can't win.
People are so invested because, well, my interpretation is you're admitting defeat. Like, you just have to keep digging in.
Your ego is invested.
Yeah. Right, not so much the facts.
Right.
There are a number of people who we've talked about who, you know, were in government office or in charge of elections who were Trump supporters who did not go along with the steal. And I think about he was a state rep in Michigan, the dairy farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
And Trump kept calling him.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't take his call. But there was a part of him that was like, but the president wants to talk to me.
Yes. Oh, there was a lot of that. Yeah. And Trump and Rudy Giuliani were actually right down on the local level trying to persuade public officials to alter their votes. And I think it was in Michigan, and this has since come out, that Trump spoke to the panel of, I don't know if they're called judges or the election judges, whose job it was to certify the count. And there were two women on the board who changed their vote after phone calls from Donald Trump. And when we interviewed them, they would not tell us what Trump said to them. Since then, there have been criminal charges filed in Michigan, and they have admitted that Trump convinced them to change their vote. But it didn't work because the majority of the people on the panel still did the right thing. And, you know, that's what I found to be the most heartening thing about this whole story, is that people like Clint Hickman, people who were in a position to betray their trust, the trust of for their job, refused to do it. Even though, I mean, Clint Hickman started refusing phone calls from the President of the United States. And he'll tell you, and did tell us, that he was so thrilled the first time he got a phone call from the president, you know, that this was like the biggest thing that ever happened to him. And after a while, he was just, when his phone would indicate it was the White House or Rudy Giuliani, he would tell his wife, I'm not answering that phone because they, you know, they want me to do something that I'm not going to do.
What do you attribute the difference between the people who wanted the steal and these folks who could have amassed power by going along with this lie to be in Trump's orbit? What did you find in them? I mean, besides they wanted to be honest, but was there anything else that you saw in them?
I think, Natalie, that the distinguishing feature was someone, and this wasn't true of everyone, but in most cases, people who had a public trust, who held a position of responsibility, either they had been appointed or elected, refused to betray that trust. Not everyone, but most did. Others, like there's this guy named Bill Feehan, who was one of the fake electors from Wisconsin. I think it was Wisconsin. We know he was just, He didn't have, he was like, I think he was the chairman of the Republican Party in his county in Wisconsin. So he did not have an elected position or a position of public responsibility. So he was willing to go all out. I mean, he was a fake elector. He signed papers saying that Trump won the election in Wisconsin as an official elector from the state of Wisconsin, even though he was not entitled to because Trump had in fact lost the election. And he stands now, he very likely will be indicted for that, because in Arizona and I believe in Georgia, several of the states have now criminally indicted the fake electors who, because they signed documentation claiming to honestly representing the vote count in their state, which proved to be untrue. In Pennsylvania, they were smart enough to have a caveat in the papers that they signed saying that it was that they were official Trump electors if Trump won his court case, right? And Trump lost every one of his court cases. So they're off the hook, because even though they did the same thing that everyone else did, their lawyers were smarter, and they included that in the... But that was a nefarious plan.
And I just want to underscore that the people in these rural counties or these small towns, like, who were in charge, who were Trump supporters, the isolation, I mean, there was the postmaster who was attacked. These are people who voted for Trump, and their neighbors were turning against them because they were doing the right thing. The woman in Michigan who, you know, signed birth certificates, who stamped, you know, important documents.
Right. Her friends.
Friends and neighbors who didn't understand how elections or government worked were really ostracized. Do you think any of those folks who did the right thing are going to stick by Trump this time?
I think that...
Or vote for, I should
say. I think a lot of them aren't going to do it anymore, and that's a real shame. I mean, one of the real lessons from the 2020 election that I'm not sure we've learned is we need to protect the people who volunteer for these jobs, to count votes, to certify votes. These are not people being paid a lot of money to do what they do, and they've been unmercifully harassed, and their lives have been turned upside down. And there have been, to my knowledge, no criminal charges. It's not true. There was a criminal charge against one of the people who threatened the life of Clint Hickman in Arizona, and he was sent to jail. But that's one of the rare instances where people who threaten election workers have been brought to justice. So I think a lot of people will think long and hard about doing this kind of volunteer election work. And yeah, I think some of them may still vote for Trump. But I think mostly the people that we talk to who saw and who were the subject of this effort to lie and to falsify the results were pretty disillusioned by it. And I doubt very seriously whether they would, they're still Republicans, but they would not be Trump supporters.
And that's what makes this scary, because they didn't win this time with the steal, but now they know the ropes, what could happen this
year.
Yeah,
I don't think this will happen again.
Okay.
I really don't. I think that too many people have gotten in too much trouble. This was a...
I did go to Leah's Facebook page, though,
yeah, right.
After
well,
reading
Leah,
this book.
She still feels the way she feels. But, I mean, lawyers who have gone into court and made false arguments have been disbarred. They have been brought up on criminal charges. Rudy Giuliani, for one. Electors, fake electors, have been indicted in states around the country. I don't think people will be that dumb. That they will do this again. Who knows what will happen the next time?
We will leave on that optimistic note. Thank you so much, Mark, for being here and for this work.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.